Hi, this is Katrina and Sass, and this is Zooming in the Lens podcast. It's adventures of spiritual dialogue with us from the streets of rock and roll into the shifts of perceptions. We hope Zooming in the Lens can bring us all together, sharing the stuff of life and practice, suffering and grace. And we're really grateful to all of you who might be listening to our rants with compassion and curiosity. For more information, visit us at functionalyogaonline.com. Hey, it's Katrina and my friend,
Sassy! This is Sass Jordan.
This is Katrina Chester, and welcome to Zooming in the Lens podcast. We're here for our seventh episode. Seventh, yeah.
Jeez. Already seven. Holy moly.
Already seven.
Mm-hmm. That's, I mean, really, it's hard to believe that we have been doing this that long.
But although it also feels like we've been doing this forever.
I don't know if that's a good thing, Kat.
Well, I think I mean it in a natural sense. Like, it doesn't feel strange.
I got it. I know what you mean.
But it's a journey doing this. I don't know how you feel about it. But for me, it's been very much a really interesting practice, because when you hear yourself back, oh, my word, the gremlins come out.
Yeah. Not exactly the most festive experience of all time. It's like when you're singing, though. I mean, it took me a long time to get used to hearing my singing voice coming back to me.
Did it?
Through speak. Oh, yeah. I couldn't stand it for the longest time. And now I am able to hear it more in context of the song, as opposed to whether or not I got that note right, or I don't like the vibrato there or what have you. But, yeah, it took me a long, long time. It sounded so alien. It doesn't sound the same coming through the speakers, as you know, as it does in your head.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And remember, also, when you hear
yourself talking, you hear all the little ticks and all the, you know, habits of speech that we have that we don't necessarily realize we're doing. You know, because we're computing at the same time as we're speaking normally. We're not actually listening to the sound come back.
That's right.
It's pretty horrible.
Yeah, this
However.
Is, this is how I discovered that I smack from these podcasts. And you know, the funny part about it is that when I called Ian, who does all the editing and the music for us, I said to him, you know, he was my guitar player for years in Lux. And when I said to him, I want to get a pop screen because I keep smacking, he's so kind that he just sort of said, yeah, you know, yeah. And I was like, wait a minute, why do you sound like you're hesitating? He said, well, a pop screen, which is almost it looks like a
nylon stocking.
Yes, thank you. A nylon stocking that goes in between you and the microphone, so it helps you with the P's and the S's.
Yeah.
So when I said that, I said, well, why did you pause? And he said, well, a pop screen's not going to help you. And I said, well, what do you mean? He said, you've been smacking for 20 years. He goes, when we would record you, because he was our engineer for a while with our producers throughout the records that we made, he said that was just like a known thing that I do, but I don't do it when I'm singing. And he goes, and you don't do it when you're in person with somebody. But anytime you were in an interview or you had to talk into the microphone, I all of a sudden became like, yeah, like, yeah.
You got to stop talking about this because it's really making me laugh and I got to stop right now. Okay. Okay. Well, anyways, I think it's endearing.
Well, I'm really glad to hear you say that, but I don't assume anybody else out there is going to feel very endeared to my smacking. So I am trying not to smack, but then it makes me sound like Orson Welles.
Well, then there's the main issue is talking over each other. That's really hard to avoid. But I mean, I think everyone does that.
that's why it's a practice. And we're just vulnerable enough to let everybody listen to us practicing, because we listen back to the first, the second, the third, and Sass and I are going, oh, okay, so if we put the teachings of how to truly listen into this, if we put the teachings on how to truly give space, hold space, we both go, wow, you feel like you're doing these things in daily life, but then when there's a moment that you're recording yourself that's frozen in time, and you get to hear back, like, I'm not doing anything of the such.
It makes me laugh again. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. It's very challenging to put these practices that sound so simple in theory into practice. Putting the practice into practice.
Yeah.
Not the easiest thing in the
and
world.
And everybody translates these sorts of things in different ways. I mean, how many times I've heard people say about podcasts, oh, I like this one, but now the podcast has gotten boring. You know, not in regards to ours, because ours hasn't been out long enough for people to get to that conclusion, I hope. But
well, I don't know about that.
And that's okay too, really, you know, but
yeah, who cares?
I think it's a vulnerable thing to do, to just put yourself out there. And I'm sure everybody else feels that way when they're starting like a new job and a new relationship. And I think all the great things that happen to us happen through vulnerability.
Yeah. Well, social media, same thing too. I mean, when it started, it felt like, you know, who am I bearing my soul to? Because it's a sort of a vast emptiness, it seems like, which is why people get in so much trouble when they start tweeting or Facebooking things that are perhaps not appropriate if they want to keep their job, or they won't, you know, they don't want to be pilloried for their political views or what have you. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. And imagine if, like, we're having to listen back to our podcasts and go through the practice of, okay, that's what I said, or that's what I sound like, or this is what I'm doing. But what if everybody every week got an email from their Facebook page and it spoke to them and said, here's what you posted all week. And until you click that you've read every single thing, you're locked out of Facebook.
Like a punishment?
No, like you have to be responsible for what you are saying, which is what podcasting feels like. And you and I are forgiving of listening to podcasts and hearing people talk, and when they make mistakes or they say something stupid or they talk over each other and, oh, that's annoying, or whatever judgments. But we don't know who's listening to this and who has the same sort of openness. So that's why this is a great practice, because we don't know, and we're putting ourselves out there regardless. And on Facebook or any other social medias, it's so easy to just type something and press send, and then we never really see it again. So if we had to see it every week, a collection of everything that we've said, maybe it could have the same effect on us as podcasting does, or recording ourselves. And
I really like the idea that you just put forth there of taking responsibility for yourself in the world and the ideas and stuff that you put out there. The thing is it can get really tricky, because if you're coming from a place of self, what's the word?
Criticism.
You know, I can't remember criticism. That's not the word. It's, you know, like on when they watch films and they censor, if you come from a place of self censorship, you can end up sounding or being really vanilla. Mm-hmm. And losing all the spice. If you're worried about what other people are going to say or think about you, you know, that's really what happens. I had to do that in that TV show that I used to do, which was called Idol, you know, the Canadian Idol, the Idol franchise, because being on television in a family type broadcast on a family type show, you had to be really, you know, careful, as well as not wanting to destroy anybody's confidence or how they felt about themselves in a positive manner, you know? So I still have a little bit of that left over in me from that self-censorship thing that I really had to kick into, which was so opposite from what we normally did, which was, you know, being a rock singer on a stage in a nightclub or on a, you know, at a festival where you just let it all hang out, baby, and you could do whatever you want. In fact, you were expected to be that way. Role-playing, once again, role-playing. But taking responsibility, that, to me, is the key to life.
How would you apply that?
I would say, to my observation, our culture, because I can't speak for any other culture, I don't live in it. This is the only one I live in. So in our culture, we have been encouraged since birth to put the responsibility for ourselves outside of ourselves. And what I mean by that, if you're sick, you must go to a doctor. Right there, the authority is outside of yourself. You see what I mean? If you if you're living in the community that you're living in, it's not up to you to clear up the trash or do this or do that. No, that's the government's, or it's the government that is involved, you know, has to do all this stuff for you. Why isn't this working out? It's the government. It, like, health and health is such a big one right there. I'm just going to go right there. Your health and well-being. We're encouraged to completely let go of any authority or any responsibility in that matter.
Right.
I find that, and that bleeds through into every other aspect of living in our culture. You know, it's not my fault. It's their fault. It's always someone else's fault.
Yes, that's so true. It's so true.
And so I think it moves into something like spirituality. This is, you know, incendiary stuff I'm talking about, like flammable stuff I'm talking about here, into spirituality, organized religion. Somebody else has put the structure together for you, and this is the steps that you take, and these are the words that you say, and you will get into the kingdom of heaven this way. Organized religion, you know? Now, you know, and I know there's obviously a great deal more to it than just that. But what I'm saying is, once again, the onus is not on the individual. The responsibility does not lie with the individual. It lies with the institution.
Mm.
And spirituality, in my view, begins when you step up to the plate and you say, I'm going to take responsibility for myself, for my views, my actions, and the way I talk about things in public, like that, you know what I mean? The way I express myself, et cetera, et cetera. And from the footsteps that I leave on this planet, because I'm only here for a short time. And do I want to leave a massive destruction in my wake, or do I want to... Or do I want to move through that landscape and leave nothing to indicate that I've been here at all? Leave it as it was before I moved through it? Or do I want to add something to it? Wow, I just went off on a tangent.
Nice.
But I have no idea where I'm going with that. I'm not going
to
lie.
Well, I think what you said was great. And
what? Katrina, what? It's like that quote that I was talking about to you earlier. I'm just going to read it to you quickly to jog your memory, and then I want you to say what you were going to say, because I think this is all part of it.
Sounds great.
The quote was from a man called Theodore Rosak, the voice of the earth, and the quote was, "Our complex global economy is built upon millions of small private acts of psychological surrender, the willingness of people to acquiesce in playing their assigned parts as cogs in the great social machine that encompasses all other machines. The capacity for self-enslavement must be broken.
Translation, please.
Well, to me, that is pretty much exactly what I was talking about. It's about taking self-enslavement mean to me becoming a slave to your own blind habits, etc., that have been created for you by what appears to be on the outside, you know, culture, all the stuff that you've been imprinted with, all the stuff that you've been programmed with. To me, that if you do not question these things on any level, that's a form of self-enslavement. And self-enslavement, to me, would be denying self-responsibility, not taking responsibility, not being the authority for yourself. You're the last word, not something outside of you. It's never something else's fault. If it is their fault, it's because you've given them the power to be at fault. What do you think?
I think that what you're talking about, in my own experience, what those rules and the confines of society, whether it be through politics or religion, it squashed my imagination because it was trying to give me answers. And when it gave me answers, I stopped asking the questions. And instead, I started to feel that anarchy, that I need to go against the system, which to me is just doing the same thing as going with the system. Because just because we want to maybe think for ourselves doesn't mean that we have to go against that which we're trying to part from. So it's just like in relationships, this feeling like we all need to have a reason to end a marriage or end a relationship. And usually those reasons are coming from anger because it's the easiest emotion to separate ourselves because it feels like we're protected by this anger. And I think for me, I was a little girl, and I might have said this in the Get to Know the Girls podcast, our very first one, but I was raised Roman Catholic, and I had to go to religious study after school. And I sat in the class one day when I was probably about 9 or so. I'm not exactly sure, but I was young. And the nun was speaking about how Jesus rose from the grave, literally got up, the shroud fell there, and he walked out, and he was then seen in the streets. And this wasn't proof of our abilities as a race. This was proof that he was special, which then made us not. And even in my little brain, somehow that made me question if there's other ways to think about things. So in that class, I raised my hand. She said, "What?" And I said, "Is there any way that what could have happened for Jesus is that it's poetry. And in the poetry, it becomes in the heart for your translation of it. I mean, I wasn't saying this at 9 years old, but this is the adult me translating it. What I really said was, could it be that Jesus didn't actually get up in physical form with flesh and bones, which I come to find out later is not really what the Catholics meant either, but this was what the nun was telling me at the time, that, and or how my brain translated it, that she meant flesh and bones. So nobody's to blame here, but the message that I got from saying this and asking if maybe it could be that what happened with Jesus is that Jesus was energy and he rose from the grave to show us all our capabilities and our powers, that everything, not everything that we have can be seen. So the wise people that have come before us, and that could be any wisdom, that could be your father's wisdom, your aunt's wisdom, Buddha's wisdom, but when you hear wisdom, there's a part of us that I feel knows that it's wisdom, and then the mind might take a hold of it. So the practice is to try to stand nowhere so you could hear both and not be partial to either one of them, creating all these opinions. Well, that nun did not like that at all. And she kicked me out.
No.
Yeah, she did. She did.
A nine-year-old kid.
Yeah.
She kicked you out of the classroom for having intelligence.
Blasphemy.
For asking a question. Well, I guess that was her conditioning, right? What else could it have been? Blasphemy.
It is,
a nine-year-old. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
I don't think that in our politically correct society that would go over as well in this day and age.
No. I would hope not. I would hope not, because for me, I try to encourage people to get back the imagination that we once had when we were little. When I work with certain people that say, I can't get myself there mentally to imagine that there's a dinosaur coming over the mountain. Just like, let's just say that, for instance, like, I can't activate that part of me. It doesn't exist, but it does exist. It does exist in all of us to have that imagination. And why imagination has served me so well is because no matter what my Katrina 2, you know, which is the things I think and feel and my opinions, no matter how alluring she may be to me, if I can imagine and activate that part of me, the whole world is open for me to translate. And the message that I got in that religious study as a kid wasn't whether I was right about Jesus or she was right about Jesus. It was that I should not ask questions, and I should not question authority, and I should not, definitely not question if God is real and if Jesus is real. But I don't feel like you even have to question those things to look for different translations. So I'm not even saying religious practices aren't exactly where they need to be. But us taking responsibility, as you said, individually, is both embracing those practices and embracing our right to have the imagination and to cultivate that imagination as an adult when we've been told that what's the purpose of thinking about a dinosaur coming over the mountain? Like, I don't have time for that. I got to work. And what's the purpose of imagining I could see my breath or whatever it is, guided meditations. But that's why I love the scripture of the Gita so much, because its interpretations are allowing for us to remember how important it is to play. And we lose that. We lose that as we get older. It's not cool or it's not adult-like. And we're always striving for a result and a goal
that is coming to us from something that appears to be outside of us, right?
Right. But what I really learned from all of these kind of conversations was that for me to down the other side, it is making my information, my discoveries, stay as knowledge and not move to the state of wisdom. So I have a perfect actual quote from the Tao Te Ching that describes this a little better. When people see some things as beautiful, other things become ugly. When people see some things as good, other things become bad. Being and non-being create each other. Difficult and easy support each other. Long and short define each other. High and low depend on each other. Before and after follow each other.
I love that quote.
Yeah, right? It allows us to just, yeah, exactly. It makes me feel freedom rather than this myopic vision of I'm right and you're wrong. If you're so right, if you are so right, it's a being, not a knowing. And if it's a being, it's not so easily insulted by other opinions.
Absolutely. Amen.
So challenge yourself, as I do, by reading religion and different belief systems and different customs and cultures and myth, deities, everybody's opinions, you know, they vary on, I won't bow down to a guru, I will not look at a statue and pray to it, and I will not believe that Jesus is God's son. I will believe that Jesus is God's son. Mm-hmm. I feel like when we don't make individual translations through life within the obvious, like poetry and music, the things of today, it limits our ability to find movement, fluidity, and translation into our own life. When you're in a job that you really don't want to be in, when you want to leave your boyfriend or your boyfriend leaves you, when somebody passes away, if we keep to the rules and don't ask questions, don't worry about it, because if truth is truth, the questions are not going to harm the topic. They're not going to harm faith. Is a being, belief to me is more of, I have to try to get it.
Or defend it.
Yeah. So if you really believe something, you feel almost married to it and a defender of it. But if I stay in faith, it has to do with me. How's it going to hurt anybody to embrace all of these belief systems, politics aside, just the belief systems and how they stand on their own, for you to translate them to mean something for your life right now, right here? And I think translations is a really important topic to look at everything like you and I do. And we have varying opinions at times, but why don't we get angry? Because we're not attached to them. We're attached to other things, but these things we're not attached to, because I think we see the bigger picture of there's wisdom in so much stuff. Who is reading the quote? Who is in you is reading the scripture? If you're constantly looking to have your belief system verified, then you're going to be insulted by different things. Mm-hmm. But there's some amazing messages in all of this.
And the thing that's so intriguing to me about it is the fact that the messages appear to have a similarity of content. They all seem to have a similar vibration, the underlying vibration of which would be they're loving. It comes from a place that feels like love. And if I was to describe love, I mean, non-judgmental would be right up there.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a billion words that you can't really describe love, can you? But non-judgmental. So the similarity of content across all religions and all types of thought, it seems to come from a place of non-judgment and non-exclusivity.
Mm.
It's inclusive, and it makes you feel more open and freer.
Mm.
It's emancipating.
Mm.
That's how I gauge the worth or the validity of information that I come across. Does it make me feel more expanded, or does it make me feel more contracted? And you know what? To tell you the truth, I'm going to tell you something privately in front of other people. Because I forget we're talking on a podcast.
Right.
But to be completely honest, I use that same criteria around other humans. Does the presence of this other human here make me feel expanded or contracted? I'm not kidding. Inside, like that feeling you get in the pit of your stomach, like, mm-hmm. ugh, or yay, or is it just neutral? After the encounter, I'll go off once I'm alone. That's when I start to dissect the sensation. Go, is it the mood I'm in? Is it coming from me, or was it actually coming from what appears to be the other? The really interesting little thing right there. But anyways, back to the idea that information can be gauged as to its validity for you, yourself, the individual, on whether or not it makes you feel more expanded or more contracted. Does that make sense to you?
It does, as a noticing, right? So as a noticing, not because we want to feel contracted and not because we want to feel expansive, because my practice tends to not go after anything, but just try to be present with what is.
Is, yeah.
And all of those things are, let's say, different levels of my incarnation, but still not me to me. So if I'm standing as the witness, which just to me is this place that's just stating fact. It's not in judgment, it's reporting. It's
reality.
It's reporting. I mean, yeah, I hate to use the word reality because I think it's so relative. It depends on what reality and who's looking and who's asking. But yes, you know, it's just a reporter of me. And if I can cultivate the witness in moments when I feel contracted or expanded, as my practice gets deeper and deeper, I could do it in the moment when I meet somebody. I can notice a place in my body that might feel contracted or expanded. And then the witness can report there's contraction, there's expansion, but not for a result, not to say, oh, I don't want to be with this person because I feel contracted, or I want to be with this person, I'm going to hang out with them more because it's expansive. Because that's just like making one religion good and another belief system bad. So the object is to not stand anywhere, but to also learn how to embrace and forgive ourselves when our twos have these opinions of what's good and bad, because we're expressing ourselves, but the path to freedom is to use what we have to transcend, to stand in that place of freedom. It doesn't have to look like I'm now blah, sitting here and I have no opinions and no this and no that. It's not a place of weakness. It's a place of non-grasping, non-clinging. And if I don't cling to my opinions, but I notice them, I'm stronger than I am when other people have to then agree with me and or not agree with me. So the contraction expansion thing with a person is an interesting one to notice. I just smacked.
That contracted me, you fucker.
My witness is noticing smacking. Right? And I notice that contraction, but what it stops me from doing is blaming the person that's making me feel contracted or expanded, which then stops me from clinging to want to be around people that constantly expand me and stay away from those who contract me. There's lessons in both.
It brings you back to self-responsibility.
That's exactly it.
That's fantastic. I really liked how you did that. That was impressive.
Oh.
Now, speaking of smacking, there's a little quote from one of my most favorite poets on the planet.
Is it Smack Crackle Pop?
It's
Is that, he's such a great poet. Wow. So
smack
deep.
Down. Smack that.
Yeah. Smack no, Crackle it's Pop. From,
oh, I'm sorry. I'm talking over you. It's from Hafiz. I don't know how to say it. I don't know what the
Hafiz.
Right... Yeah, I don't know the right accent for it. Hafiz, mm-hmm. whatever. Anyways, all that to say, the quote that kills me, it's so beautiful. It says, stay close to any sounds that make you glad you are alive.
Mm.
Yes, my brother. All I can think of is birds when I love bird song. I could hear them singing behind you in this podcast. And
yeah.
I'm like, oh, yeah. God, that sound is just
isn't it beautiful?
So, it's the most beautiful sound in the world to me. It's like, I'll tell you what, on the deathbed, on my exit from this matrix, I would love to be listening to birds singing as I go out.
Oh, I'll do that for you, Sassy.
Okay, thank you. Oh, am I going first?
Yeah, that did sound like that, didn't it? It did sound like that. No, well, I could record myself doing like, and then somebody can play it for you if I'm gone first.
Okay, sounds good. You're on, sister.
You know that quote in honor of translations.
Mm-hmm.
Can you read that again?
Okay, I can. I just have to open it up on the iPad because I want to say it exactly right. It says, stay close to any sounds that make you glad you are alive.
Okay, so I look at that and I think to myself, the one way to translate that is the sounds of horns don't make me feel alive. That's not a glad feeling. So I imagine that there's some people out there that are saying, well, that's why I'm just doing the things that make me happy. But on the other side of the translation of it, things that make me glad I'm alive, when people are recently diagnosed or on their deathbed, they get this amazing awareness that even the suffering is a feeling, is a burning, is a certification that we're alive. Mm-hmm. So can the bad sounds, it's a societal word, bad,
mm-hmm.
can the sounds that annoy you make you glad to be alive? It depends on where you're at in life. If you're on your deathbed, I imagine, and I do know that any sound makes you glad because you're here and you're alive.
Mm-hmm.
When you maybe are younger, say, I don't know what age, but when you get to that place where you want everything perfect and I used to do this all the time living in Manhattan. I would go to make a phone call. Every time I would go to make a phone call, it was beautiful and quiet on the streets in New York City. I know, ridiculous to imagine that that was actually true, but at that point, even cars and traffic, that was beautifully silent to me. That was my translation. But every time I would go to make a phone call, they would say hello on the other end. And exactly at that moment, fire engines.
All hell broke loose.
Combat vehicles. Helicopters. I literally felt like there was an alarm that went off in the land of the annoying. Katrina's on the phone. Sound the alarm. And as if I am anywhere near and close to that sort of importance, right? But that's what the ego mind says. And everything would be so loud that I couldn't talk on the phone. At that moment in my life, everything was happening to me, and it was annoying me, and it was horrible. But if I go back to when I was diagnosed and told that I might not make it, one of the things that were affected was my hearing. Everything got so super loud. So even the slightest sound of tapping became loud in my ears. So I had to be in this room that was very padded, and I couldn't have any sound because it would bring immense pain to my head and to my eyes. So at that moment in my life, I needed no sound. So my point in all of that is to say that, do you hear that sound? I think your mic is... Yeah.
Yeah, I can't hear you. Okay.
So at that time, no sound was better. So being able to use translations in the way we're talking about them can bring you to closer to what's true. Ooh, Sass, you're making a lot of noise with that mic. So translations is a great way to look at life through the eyes of all this wisdom and apply it to our own life. How can we see our relationship differently? How can we... Instead of how you started this, Sass, instead of looking externally at it being your girlfriend or your wife or your husband's fault, can it be something that you look from within first? Shine the flashlight on yourself. What part do we have to play? What responsibility can we take? The responsibility we could take, even when you don't want to be wrong, more than anything, is to say, ask questions. Ask the question, how can I translate this in a different way? If you know you're right in the middle of a fight with somebody, you won't be that scared to do it. But when we get mad and when we're in arguments, we're fighting because we need others to understand. You're not understanding. You're not really hearing me. And that's the desire, almost like we're trying to convince ourselves. If you're that right, if I'm that right, or am I saying it backwards? If I'm that mad, I'm not believing it myself.
That's right.
Yeah. Sorry,
that's
I
right.
get confused.
No, that's exactly right. Absolutely 100%.
So and then that, you can play.
And that's what we were talking about earlier. There comes the defense. That's another good way to gauge whether or not you are being or just defense. Am I going into defense? If I'm going into defense, that means I'm not convinced of it myself.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yes, that's right. And usually the people closest to us, the people we love the most, have the ability to trigger that defense in us. And it feels like it should be the exact opposite.
Right. Got it. Exactly.
Well,
indeed.
It does. It really does. And, you know, one thing too that I think when we just follow rules and not question, and by no means am I saying all of a sudden everybody should go out and have anarchy and not follow rules. What I'm saying is, can you both follow rules and create the questions still? Can you still ask questions while following the rules?
Yeah.
And those questions are internal questions. I'm not saying don't discuss them outwardly. Sass and I all the time ask each other questions that are just maybe rhetorical, or we're just listening to ourselves talk to get it out. That's what spiritual community for me is really useful, because I get to hear myself talk. Just like on these podcasts, I listen back to them and I say, wow, sometimes I'm like, I didn't even really know that I felt that way. That's interesting. And then it brings up another practice for me. Not that I'm not being honest here or in conversation with somebody else outside of here. It's that you're showing up in every moment in a new way if you're actually showing up. Otherwise, I'm just reliving the past of what I believed over and over and over again, which is what belief systems are. They're not faith systems. They're belief systems.
That's
I'm
right.
Trying to get myself to believe it. And
they're finite.
Yeah. And they squashed for me they didn't squash for me. I'm not even going to give it that much power. It tried to squash for me my imagination, my ability to see, still be a kid and standing on a couch and imagining that all around me are sharks and I have to jump from sofa to sofa to sofa. Now, I'm not asking you to do that. I do still do that. I think what allows me to still be the child and be that curious person that can play is because I'm not taking myself so seriously all the time.
That's actually what we both do.
Right.
We pretend we're pirates.
We do.
On couches. We're surrounded by sharks.
I mean, I love to play, but if you're that busy that you can't play, man, turn around and translate that to yourself.
Yeah. I think another word for translation would be interpretation, right? Interpret that.
Yeah, sure. Right? Why not? Yeah, why not?
Yeah.
I think too that when society's not cultivating it to ask questions, and especially spirituality for me is always supporting me in asking questions. Don't believe a word I say. Go out and experience it for yourself. That's what the motto is, if there was a motto. Don't believe a word. Just go out and experience it. And it's great to have a teacher that guides you, a wise friend that guides you from being able to embrace all of it and not sit so stuck, because everything in life becomes so limited if we do. If we just love cats, then we hate dogs. I know this because that was my story for a while, at least with the dog and the cat thing. All of a sudden, there's friends out there that know this and have been shocked about it. I changed my mind. Why was I scared of dogs? Because I got bit as a child. Actually, that's not even true. I got bit on tour. Ian will remember that. I got bit on tour, and I now look at that and say, so what? I'm not saying that traumas should be looked at as so what. I'm just saying, is it possible for me to drop that story? Because not one dog cannot represent the entire species of dogs. But yet my mind told me that for 15 years. And so every dog I saw, I perpetuated this story that I don't like dogs, when in fact what it was fear. And when I translated that in a different way, I was able to let dogs speak for themselves metaphorically, independently, each one. And now there are some dogs I should be scared of because they bite. That's my brain. I don't need to go into the woo-woo world of like, all dogs are great, and if they bite you, it's meant to be. No. If you feel like a dog's going to bite you, protect yourself. But I was doing it to dogs that, you know, could be the size of my thumb, you know, because overall, I was just judging dogs in general. And I see that, and I learned from that. And now I don't have those same opinions. So having imagination is what helped me do that. And being around people that can also help us cultivate that changing your mind is okay. Changing your mind is okay. I think that's why we tend to get so defensive easier with family, because with family, they tend to hold you to who you've always been. And you can't grow from that. A great example really quickly is just that my mom is obsessed with me having blonde hair. She always, always has been. I have had so many different hair colors throughout my life. So many. But yet she thinks that if I put blonde hair back into, if I put blonde streaks back in my hair, some miraculous blonde fairy is going to come down and all life is going to be fantastic again. So that's her trip, right? It's her trip. And I used to get defensive about it. I still know what it feels like to feel defensive about it. But what that ended up being was that I wasn't sure that she was right. So I got defensive. Once I felt okay with having a shaved head, not that I've had the nerve to do that yet, but once I found this freedom to that my hair is not who I am, it's like music or like art. It's an expression of who I am, and that's going to change. I could see my mother in her predicament of a memory that she wanted to be blonde, and she's jet black hair, so, you know, that was sort of coming out on me. Or maybe her opinion was that I look better with blonde hair, and she's entitled to that opinion. But family seems to hold us to these things like nothing else in the world, and love relationships, those things that we hear from our beloveds or our friends. You always do that.
This is another podcast. You start getting into family stuff. Oh, wait a minute, sister. Yeah.
That's not like you at all. Wow, I'm surprised. You've changed, or you've not changed at all. I love them. I love those. So here's this quote from Gandhi that I love. At times of writing, I never think what I have said before. My aim is not to be consistent with my previous statements on a given question, but to be consistent with truth as it may present itself to me at a given moment. The result has been that I've grown from truth to truth.
Right.
I think I've read that before.
No, not, I haven't heard you, no.
I love it because he's giving us permission, which it is that simple sometimes for me, to read a quote and to just get permission to change or to not change, to not constantly listen. Oh, and we could do that ourselves, Seth. You and I could do a podcast and say one thing then do another podcast.
Absolutely happens all the time. Things that sound contradictory, yeah.
Yeah, but the interesting thing is if you look at spirituality as you're not trying to sit somewhere, you are trying to grow.
You're fluid, malleable, yes. Movement, constant change. That's something that we get as a gender. I think women get accused of always being all over the place. Like, well, one minute you're like this, and then you get your fucking period, and you're like that. That kind of stuff. But it once again, really depends on your translation of that type of thing. Is somebody allowed to adapt to the moment and to be fluid in the moment? Or does somebody have to have a static set of rules by which they always respond?
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
The only way they can be. I can't buy that. Doesn't work for me, that one. I like the fluid one.
Although I was asleep for so long in that, because we've all labeled that societally as being a hypocrite.
Right, exactly. I'm not buying it anymore. It's a label.
No, I can't feel that. Yeah, I can't feel that anymore either. But I say that if you get one thing from this podcast, is to notice how many times you might feel like somebody's a hypocrite, because really, if you shine the light back on yourself as I am, I find out that it's my inability to accept change. So maybe it's your inability of accepting change. Maybe it's that you don't want to change yourself and somebody else changing is making you feel shitty about yourself because you can't feel like you can't make those changes. And so you want to keep everybody where you know them because that's familiar. And I think love, true love in a spiritual context has nothing to do with any of that. It's not holding people to their word. It's not making people do what they say they're gonna do because it's helping you. And I'm not trying to promote people going against their word or not keeping plans or anything like that. What I'm saying is there room for you to investigate when people don't?
Right.
That
right.
It's something inside you.
Right.
And it's not the fact that the plans are broken or that they believed in God last week and now they don't.
Right.
And instead of labeling them, can you look inside yourself to see that contraction you talked about, Sass, or that expansive feeling, and just notice which it gives you, and then translate it differently by not looking outside, but looking inside to see what that could be from, right, so that you can grow. And it doesn't mean that anything on the outside may change at all. It's just that your perception to what's out there changes.
Your interpretation, your perception, your translation, absolutely.
Yes, and definitely check out Joseph Campbell, an investigating myth. He was the king of it, and his words are so beautiful about mythology and people feeling like they can't resonate with deities because why would they be worshiping an elephant head with a man body or any of those sort of things? Like, these are all lessons. Open the mind to ask the questions of what does that deity represent? And is there a part of me that feels that I could benefit from that quality? And so could I learn that through the stories, the imagination of that story, of that belief or that faith. Just sitting there and sinking your heels down and saying deities are a bunch of crap, or I don't believe in this man in a with a white beard and sitting in a chair. Well, that's your inability to not expand past that. What does God represent? What does God feel like? What does God mean? It doesn't have to stop with you just saying, I don't believe in God. Fine. Can you not believe in God and experiment? Because that's the unattachment part of it. But when we as individuals, when I have to sit somewhere, that's when I know that I have no hope of taking knowledge and turning it into wisdom. And if you want to be creative out there and write songs and write screenplays and be creative, even in your mothering and your relationship to your lover and your relationship to your mom and your family, it takes that part of our imagination to not be constantly trying to find out who's right or wrong. Not even yourself has to be right or wrong. There's always changing. Anything in this physical world, just know right now, is always going to change. Just look at nature. Mm-hmm. No tree is the same. No animals pass away. We pass away. Everything grows. Cars get old. Even inanimate objects change. So if you know that, can you find somewhere inside of you that gives yourself permission to change your mind?
Yeah.
And not call everybody a hypocrite, including yourself. It would be so great if we got to a place in society where somebody said, wow, you changed your mind. Congratulations. Even though that's sitting somewhere too. But what if we never even noticed? If every day I met you, Sass, we met each other for the first time.
That would be weird.
Yeah, and it would be great. I feel like that's what that Groundhog movie was saying. Can he be happy waking up every day in the same thing? Because if you don't think that's life, take a look around.
That movie's brilliant. That's one of the most brilliant spiritual documentaries I've ever seen.
Yeah, I think so too. I think so too. And his reaction to it every day. Oh my God, here I am in the same thing again, slapping his alarm clock down.
Yeah.
It's like, brilliant. If that's how we look at life, there's no imagination whatsoever. All he wanted to do was get out of it and wake up to a new day. And all we do is rush to the end. Got to get to the result. Got to get to the ending. Got to get to the end of life.
I have such a huge thing about all of that. What
so
is
go
the big
watch
rush?
That. Go watch that movie again, Groundhog Day.
Yes.
And when he, I won't tell you the end, but when he finds that all there is that, it's your reality.
It blows all the doors open.
That's right. So check out Joseph Campbell, watch Groundhog Day over again. Check
Read
out Hafiz. Yeah, and Rumi.
And Rumi. Same, Rumi. Not the same, but very much, very, they were both Sufi mystics. So, yeah.
And Kabir. Poets. Yes. And if I'm going to recommend a Joseph Campbell book, I'd say The Power of Myth with mm-hmm. Bill Moyers is a fantastic book to discover how great myths are. I mean, really, the stories of myths and being able to translate them to you. But of course, first and foremost, I'll recommend the Bhagavad Gita.
And is there a particular translation you would recommend?
Yes, I'd say that if you're interested in seeing more classic works of it, I'm trying to find it right now. It was sitting right here. Where is my little red book? It's a little red book, and I can't seem to find it.
I think that's the one
here
my
it
mom
is.
Has. Yeah.
Okay, here it is. The Bhagavad Gita, which means the song of God, the song divine. This little one is by Gita, G-I-T-A Press, comma, G-O-R-A-K-H-P-U-R. I really dig this one. It's little, but it gets to the point, and it still feels like it's very classic. If you're looking for an American translation, I dig Stephen Mitchell. Stephen Mitchell, you can get it on Amazon.com. So I love these, and I love the translations. I also want to recommend a philosophy teacher named Carlos Palmera. He's from Spain. He was a monk, and that's who I learned the Gita from. And he's got some DVDs out there. I don't know where to get them, but if you just Google Carlos Palmera, he has amazing translations from his lineage, DVDs. So you could see him and you can hear him, and he explains to you what the story of the Bhagavad Gita can mean as a roadmap to how to live life. So you could translate that any way you like, but I work from all of those and many other translations too, because I like to see all the different ways that I can mm-hmm. translate it, because then it helps me in my own translations for when I'm in pain or when I have an argument with somebody or whatever. But it's such a great tool and a skill. So thanks,
Seth.
Thank you for your translations, too sassy.
Oh, God. As long as it made some sort of sense, it's cool.
Well, you know, we're in practice right now, so it may not make sense when we listen back to it, but all we can do is hope that other spiritual seekers that are watching this are going to understand that this is us growing.
Yeah.
And changing.
And on that note, I'm off for a run, believe
awesome.
It or not.
Good for you, man. Good for you. Awesome.
So I'll see you next time.
Yes, I'll see you next time. And if anybody wants to connect, you could go to functionalyogaonline.com. And there's a new course being offered right now from Ram Dass and myself called Zooming in the Lens. And it's sort of like a community like this online. And I think the next group is going to be forming around May 12th. And then it's going to start somewhere June 9th or June 11th. So if you're interested in being a part of something like this, you could go read the testimonies of Group One, which I just finished, all in an effort to raise community of like-minded people like us so that we can open up dialogues. No question is too stupid and no translation is too stupid and no belief is wrong and no faith is right. So with that, take care, everybody.
We bid you adieu. See you next time.
See you later.
Bye.
Bye.
One fine evening, I was in my favorite restaurant there. It was a Greek restaurant. And at the table were sitting a father, a mother, and a scrawny little boy, about 12 years old. The father says to the boy, drink your tomato juice. And the boy says, I don't want to. And the father, with a louder voice, says, drink your tomato juice. And the mother says, don't make him do what he doesn't want to do. Father looks at her and he says, he can't go through life doing what he wants to do. Said, if he does only what he wants to do, he'll be dead. Look at me. I've never done the thing I wanted to in all my life. I said, my God. Babbitt incarnate. And that's the man who never followed his bliss. Well, you may have a success in life, but then just think of it. What kind of life was it? What good is it? You've never done the thing you wanted to in all your life.
What happens when you follow your bliss?
You come to bliss in Sanskrit, which is the great spiritual language of the world, and they know all about it and have known about it for a long time. The transcendent is transcendent. But there are three terms that bring you to the brink. You might say the jumping off place to the ocean. And the three terms are Sat, Chit, Ananda. And Sat, the word Sat means being. Chit means full consciousness. And Ananda means rapture. So I thought, I don't know whether my consciousness is full consciousness or not. I don't know whether my being is a proper being or not, but I do know where my rapture is. So let me hang on to rapture, and that'll bring me both being and full consciousness, and it works.
Music and editing, special thank you to Ian Hatton. If you'd like more information on Ian, go to mixforpix.com.